Deer Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Danger, danger. The following contains explicit content. Please use caution while you are tuned in.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Kevin Staples.
And you're listening to Rainbow Country
with Mark Terra.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the persons appearing on the program.
Today on Rainbow Country, Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story. That and more in episode 439, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbie Q.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, Emmy-nominated producer Bruce David Klein joins me in conversation to talk about his latest film, Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story, a documentary about the legend Liza Minnelli. We'll find out about the making of this powerful new documentary, as well as having access to 25 hours of never-before-seen footage of Liza Minnelli. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house, and on this episode, I'm featuring some classic funk, some queer rap, and more. All that lies ahead as we start journey 439 through Rainbow Country, and our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning, best-selling author Michael Bach reads from his latest book, Alphabet Soup, The Essential Guide to LGBTQ2+ Inclusion at Work. By the way, on Amazon.ca, Alphabet Soup has a rating of 4.7 out of 5 stars.
Alphabet Soup is a guide that will take you, my faithful reader, on a journey of discovery with the objective of turning you and your organization into active allies, a term I explain in the book. Like it or not, LGBTQ2+ people need allies to help us achieve that elusive goal of true inclusion. Everything in this book can be applied to a workplace and engaging with employees, as well as interactions with volunteers, customers, students, parishioners, or just everyday people on the street. When it comes to LGBTQ2+ inclusion at work and in communities, I'm always reminded of one of my favorite conversations. Many years ago, I was speaking with the head of HR for an organization located in a Western European country that shall remain nameless to protect the guilty. She was telling me about the company's work in diversity and inclusion, with no mention of work in the LGBTQ2+ communities. When I probed, she defensively explained that they don't discuss, quote, these things, end quote, at work. I looked over at a photo on her desk and asked if the man in it with her was her husband, to which she responded in the affirmative. It was a wedding photo and she was wearing a white wedding dress, so chances were good. I pointed out that the photo was a statement of her sexual orientation. I likely didn't need to ask her what sexual orientation she identified with because she had it on display. I probably should have asked, but let's focus on the point. That was an eye-opening moment for her. Organizations don't think about how much it costs to not create inclusive space for LGBTQ2+ folks, but the price tag can be quite hefty. There's the cost of lower levels of engagement, the cost of higher levels of voluntary turnover, the cost of recruitment, the cost of decreased innovation. And just like when I enter a wine store, that bill can add up fast. So how do you quantify the cost? I spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. Then, around 2005, someone from IBM shared a model with me. The first time I saw it, I thought, this is exactly what I've been trying to explain. And I used it to build a business case for why my employer needed an LGBTQ2+ employee resource group. At the top of the list of issues is the fact that the approach to educating on diversity and inclusion is traditionally one and done. You put everyone through a voluntary program and you're good, right? This is what I like to refer to as wrong. The first mistake is that your employee population isn't static. The average employee turnover rate is about 18%, but that can be a lot higher in some industries, like food service or retail. One food service employer I worked with had a turnover rate of nearly 75% of frontline workers. By the time you've trained everyone, you need to start back at the beginning to capture new people. And that cycle continues endlessly. Education should be part of onboarding. From the day a person starts, there should be mandatory D&I education, obviously with specific LGBTQ2+ content, driven by a D&I learning map that takes each person through a learning journey. The second mistake in the one-and-done approach is the idea that one program covers it all. If Black Lives Matter has shown us anything, it's that we have a lot of work to do to educate people on anti-Black and anti-Indigenous systemic racism. And that's just one topic. The conversation on LGBTQ2+ inclusion is constantly evolving, and so should your education program.
If we think of the 1970s as the period where the gay community was trying to get noticed, the 1980s was the time when we actually got noticed and started getting seriously slammed. The cops had never been happy with Trudeau's 1969 decriminalization. If you look at historian Tom Hooper's work, you'll see that arrests of gay men actually increased across the country after decriminalization. Remember, this was way before apps. If you wanted to hook up, baths or bars were the best places to go, so those were the places that police targeted. There were a series of bath and bar raids in Montreal and Toronto and Edmonton and Ottawa and other cities. The Toronto bath raids of February 5th, 1981 are the most famous. When Toronto's pro-gay mayor John Sewell and the first openly gay candidate for city council, George Hislop, were both defeated in the municipal elections in 1980, the cops figured we were vulnerable and swooped. They smashed into most of the city's gay baths, trashed the places, and arrested almost 300 men on a range of charges. It wasn't just the baths, they were also hassling the bars on concocted liquor license violations, and they were busting individuals in bookstores for porn. Basically, they were trying to shut down the gay village and recriminalize homosexuality. But that night when they hit the baths, they bit off more than they could chew. In Toronto, for the first time, the activists and the small business people and the normally non-political bar and bath patrons all came together in a series of massive demonstrations. We raised money to fight the charges in court and won. We made common cause with Black and South Asian communities who are also experiencing police brutality and harassment, and we demanded community control of the police. We called for changes to the criminal code to get rid of antiquated laws that still criminalized sex. That new community unity also laid the foundation for dealing with the next crisis that was about to affect us all, the AIDS epidemic. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Liza.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country.
Gather around, I got a story to tell.
Tonys, a Grammy, an Emmy, even an Oscar, she has done it all.
She has achieved that rare status where only a first name is necessary.
The one and only Liza.
You thought I didn't see you now, didn't you?
Born to Hollywood royalty.
Vincente Minnelli.
Superstar Judy Garland.
I thought, Mama, she's never going to pass.
Her fight was to find who she was. She didn't want to be a mother.
Her mother's passing was a catalyst.
A period of incubation.
She found friends and mentors who helped her.
He gave her an entire sense of self.
There was so much expected of her.
She had the thing that you can't teach.
She blossomed.
Everybody wanted to be with Liza. Everybody wanted her at their parties.
She's hot, she's sexy, she's weird, and she had that fierceness and so much vulnerability.
How you doing?
Terrific. Fine.
I feel wonderful about love.
Excuse me.
Because I wanted it to be like it was in the songs.
That last husband of hers, I was at the wedding. Oh my God.
Legendary actress and singer Liza Minnelli has checked into rehab.
I was very worried.
How lucky I was to have gone through all of the bad stuff that I've gone through, because it prepared me for the rest of my life.
If the public sees Liza as a barrel of sequins and glamour, they've got her wrong.
She wanted to consume the fullness of life. I don't think she has any regrets.
Stones, troll, bones. Bones. Bruce David Klein, hello, how are you?
I'm great. I'm feeling very Liza this week.
Are you? Because we're coming from a sleazy hotel room somewhere in what, Palm Beach?
We're in Palm Beach for a special event screening tonight, and then we open in New York tomorrow and in LA the following week. So this has been a whirlwind of Liza.
Well, I have to say, Bruce David Klein, thank you for being here. Especially to talk about your documentary, Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story. This is your documentary about Liza Minnelli, the one and only, the great living legend, Liza Minnelli. Let's just jump right in. You write, you produce, you direct this film. Let's go back to the very beginning, the heart, the spark that started this all off. Where does this come from? What's the genesis? What's the spark? What's the flashpoint that made you say, it's time for me to make this documentary on the legendary Liza Minnelli? What's the origins?
Sure. Looking back on it, it was actually pretty long in coming and pretty obvious that it was going to kind of come to this at some point. My first recollection of Liza was when I was too young to see Cabaret, but young enough to see the poster and say, my God, that is really naughty, and I really want to see that. So that was kind of the first instance. And then in 1980, I was old enough to see movies, and I saw Arthur. And I remember saying, oh, my God, this Liza Minnelli is such an incredible comedic talent. You know, who is she? Oh, my God. She was the one on the Cabaret poster. And so I started doing a deep dive into her at that time, you know, watching Cabaret and Sterile Cuckoo and her movies before that. But what really happened to me, and it was actually a very moving moment in my life, very memorable, was in 2008, I went and saw Liza's at the Palace on Broadway. And, you know, at that time, there was a very, very big question as to whether or not Liza could still sing. She had gone through some health issues. She had gotten through the wild marriage. And there was a big question. And people were like, can she still sing? Can she still dance? And, you know, can she still act? Can she still perform? And I will never forget it. I mean, this was just a seminal moment in my kind of love of culture moment, where, there were hushed, everybody was hushed in the audience. What would she look like? What would she do? And she came out and the spotlight just shot on her. And she immediately did one of these kind of Liza, I'm not going to, you know, do Liza now, but a Liza hand hip kind of signature move. And the audience lost its mind in a way I've never seen before or after. I've seen all the greats perform, Frank Sinatra, David Bowie, Rolling Stones, everybody. I have never seen anything like this where people were, you know, as I say, not just giving her a standing ovation, but standing on the Broadway seats and grown men and women with tears streaking down their cheeks. I mean, I had never seen anything like that. And I remembered at that moment, my God, this woman has a hold on people that goes way beyond. I like her music, way beyond. I like, you know, her movie, or I like her as an actress. I like her as a performer. This was something very profound and a very, very deep connection. So when we started talking to the Liza people at the behest of someone in our office, our co-producer, Dana Craig, who worked with Alex Goldstein, our producer. And Dana said, oh, my God, we have to put Liza on our list of prospective subjects. And when we started calling the Liza people, we were, you know, at the beginning feeling each other out. What are your credits? What have you done? You know, Liza does very few things, blah, blah, blah. And then they said the most incredible words you can to a documentarian, which is, you know, by the way, Liza just found 25 hours of never before seen footage from the 1970s. Are you interested in seeing it? You know, and I will never forget it. We got some selects in, we brought it in. We all kind of sat around and watched it. And I like to say there were people multi-generational, because everybody has a different memory or connection with Liza. I always say that some people think she's a great sitcom star because of Arrested Development. You know, some people know her as, oh, she did the cameo in Sex and the City. So when we hit play and we started watching the footage, it was so incredibly moving to see this explosive talent at her height. She was the Taylor Swift. She was the it girl of that era. And, you know, in the decades since, there were a lot of other things we think of Liza for. You know, she had toured with Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. She had had some challenges with marriages and substance abuse. So to see her at her height, we said this has to be the core of a film. So we went back to them and kind of pitched this idea of using the 70s as this kind of era of, you know, how when Liza became Liza, which was actually the original title of the film. And they kind of connected at that moment and said, okay, we entrust this material and Liza's story to these people. So that's kind of the long-winded answer as to, but the truth of how everything came back. I'm not sure either could have happened, meaning had I just had that kind of emotional connection with Liza alone, without the Liza on the list, you know, us calling Liza and then suddenly finding the footage, wouldn't have happened. And vice versa, had I just, you know, reached out to Liza and we talked to them, but I hadn't had that kind of emotional connection because me and Broadway have a kind of long, rich history. I produced a film called Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened, which was about Sondheim and Hal Prince's Merrily We Roll Along and the creation of it and how it didn't do well at the beginning but became a cult classic. So I'm always kind of totally engaged by Broadway stories and big, over-the-top, juicy Broadway stories. And in many ways, there's no one bigger or more over-the-top or juicier than Liza's story.
Okay. So, quote, shut the fuck up, unquote. That's said by Liza Minnelli during your interview with her.
The very early in the film, it's almost the first thing she says.
The very opening of this documentary, essentially, it's a sort of behind the scenes setup. The very opening. Talk to me about why you chose to open the film the way that you did.
That's an interesting question because, you know, when you make these things, I try to do the opening last because I always feel if you cut the opening at the beginning and then you end up moving on and doing the other film, it often doesn't match because the film that you make later on in the process is very different from the one that you started with the tease. So we had a lot of different versions and there was a point that I looked at it and I said, who am I kidding? It's like, this is Liza fucking Minnelli. She has to open the film. I want to fade up on her and give a flavor instantly of her personality. And I have to tell you, that opening sequence is really the first time I interviewed her. And I think that kind of captures her personality in a way that sometimes you don't expect. She really is. She's that witty. She's that funny. She's that kooky. She's that off the cuff. And I think hopefully as you get into the film, you see some of the seeds that were planted kind of in her performance by some of her mentors like Kay Thompson and these people who literally, certainly Kay, more than anybody, gave her that kind of kooky perspective of life. And that, and once you understand that, it makes sense that she would start the film, okay, Liza, we're rolling, shut the fuck up. That's essential, Liza.
Were you nervous during that first interview? How did you approach it?
That's a very interesting question. First of all, it's not a nerves. What it is, I've been doing this a long time, so not really nerves. What it is you feel a overriding sense of gratefulness that you've been given this opportunity. I mean, how many millions?
And you don't want to blow it.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to piss that person off.
How many millions of people? The pissing off doesn't bother me as much because I've done films and I've pissed off the subjects and that could be interesting also. But in Liza's case, you know, I did feel the weight of all the people in the audience at the palace who felt this enormous connection to this woman to make sure that I told her story and that it was authentic. And of course, you know, Liza is the greatest help along that because she, you know, and I tell the story, which is still amazes me that this happened to me, which is after a day of filming, Liza asked for me to come back, you know, have Bruce come back. And I went back in and she was in her bedroom sitting on the edge of the bed. And I came in, I'm like, Liza, you know, you called for me. And she reached up and she grabbed my hand and she started petting it. And she looked up at me with those kind of dark saucer eyes and said, please, Bruce, don't put in anything phony in the movie. Do not make me look like a phony. And that was one of the most incredible moments and incredible insights into Liza and her comfort with herself. Obviously, there have been times where she's glossed over things and kind of created the world as this old MGM musical of brightness and beauty and everything like that. But she wanted this to be real. And that was probably the thing that more than anything gave me kind of the backbone to be able to say, okay, we got to be truthful. Not that I wouldn't have been anyway, but that it was doubled down and I felt more easily able to ask her about some things. Because at the beginning, when you sit across from somebody, let alone an icon, you're always dancing around. You're always trying to see how far can I go? Will they talk about this? Will they talk about that? And with Liza, nothing was really, you know, off the table, which was great.
I was just going to ask you, were there any things, any topics, any subjects off limit or maybe that you wanted specifically to talk about?
No, I mean, I think she was really happy. I think one of the things that really relaxed her was that we were very interested in her mentors. I'm not sure a ton of interviewers over the years has wanted to have a really long conversation with her about Charles Aznavour and what he did for her and why she thought he was so talented. So I think when I started tapping into things that she was interested in, I think that's when things started gelling very nicely. I think that and, you know, I always say, if you want Liza to be your friend for life, you crack a joke and have her laugh. Because if she laughs once, she's your friend for life. She loves telling jokes. She loves having people around her who are funny. And I learned that pretty early on that, you know, keep the jokes coming.
The title, Liza, A Truly Terrific, Absolutely True Story. That's the full title. Is there a story behind choosing this specific title?
Well, it goes without question. We probably had a list of over 100 titles. And there was a moment when I said, okay, when you have, so rarely, I may add, a subject with a one name instant memory, Liza, everybody knows who you're talking about, that has to be the big title. So once that was kind of taken care of, it was like, okay, what could be the subtitle? And that was where we had 100 different variations. And I think ultimately I decided that it made the most sense to have a subtitle phrase that Liza herself actually said, word she actually said. So then it was a question of watching the movie, watching interviews, finding something that could be like a fun title. And when it connected with, you know, her intro written by Fred Ebb to Ring Them Bells in the Liza with a Z concert when she says, you know, I have a truly terrific, absolutely true story. And when I told this, you know, story to, you know, my friends are songwriters and they turned it. So I think it was essential Liza for a couple of reasons. One, it is so Liza, just the terminology, you know, truly terrific, you know, absolutely, you know, that's very, very, very Liza. And And I think the fact that she actually said it in an iconic moment in her early life was, you know, made sense. And I don't know why, but I seem to be partial. I'm sorry to everybody with long titles. You know, our Sondheim film was best worst thing that ever could have happened. I don't know. Sometimes you just play with words and it worked out. But it feels like, and once we kind of did the poster and you saw the layout of how the title plays out, it's like, okay, this title is going to work. So we're very happy with it.
Musical note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm Eric Radford, Olympic and world champion figure skater, pianist, and composer, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.
Hi, I'm Carol B., the host and producer of radio programs Ruby Slippers and Through the Looking Glass. In many parts of the world, one will be excluded or even persecuted just for being gay. And so it's so very important to have a program like Rainbow Country, whose mandate is to provide a platform for the LGBT community to have a voice, share ideas, and promote inclusiveness. Through thought-provoking interviews, review of cultural events, and music, your host and producer, Mark Terra, showcases the very best the LGBT community has to offer. Rainbow Country, 2 hours well spent.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Terra on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Terra providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Paul Poirier, Canadian champion in ice dance and three-time Olympian, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.
So, Bruce David Klein, you are an Emmy-nominated producer. In, I believe it was 1989, you started Atlas Media Corporation, your multi-award-winning production company. So here's my question for you. How did this all start for you? Did you start off as an actor, as a singer, as a dancer, as an instrumentalist? How did you get into the world of entertainment originally?
I was always a writer. I mean, first of all, I'll take that back. As a kid, I always made home movies, mostly horror movies, mostly of me killing my friends with blood splattering all over the place. So that was fun. But I was primarily for many years a writer, and I certainly got into entertainment and Broadway through studying writing, literature, and also lyric writing. Big fan of Stephen Sondheim, Frank Lesser, Fred Ebb. You know, just the genius of of taking a soup and making a bouillon cube out of these lyrics, where you have such a short period of time to kind of tell stories and evoke emotion. So that always fascinated me. So basically, I started Atlas Media as a vehicle for me to be able to write and produce, you know, kind of whatever excited me at that moment. Of course, you know, as the company grew, I got further and further away from actually physically writing myself, because we hired writers, we hired producers to do things. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I started going much more back to my roots and started spending a lot more time doing kind of more personal projects that were important to me. So as I said, I produced Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened. And I just did a film for HBO on the corporate raider billionaire Carl Icahn, and now Liza Minnelli. So these are things that just kind of really interest me. But my core interest has always been writing and storytelling. So that's kind of where it came from.
You've done a lot of work in television, in film. Do you have a preference as to which medium you work in?
I think it's funny because it's two sides of my personality. TV is fast, energetic, get it out there, you know, get it, you know, it's a little ephemeral sometimes, but get it out there. Film is slow and careful and thoughtful. And, you know, the Liza film really from soup to nuts took 2.5 years to do. Whereas, you know, we have done 13-part series for cable networks that, you know, are done in 4 months. So those, in effect, I think there's a reason I do both, because those are the two sides of my personality. I have a kind of hyper side wanting to do things fast, but then I have, I like to think of a more thoughtful side where I like to kind of go in deep on things that interest me.
You've produced films that have been on network television, channels like TLC, the History Channel, you just mentioned HBO, the Food Network. For yourself, when you're creating content, for you, what makes good content?
Honestly, it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. It is a great story and a great character, and that's it. It's a great story and a great character. Obviously, there generally with a great character is conflict of some sort, you know. In the case of Liza, certainly as part of our story, the conflict was, how was she ever going to get from out of her mother's shadow, her mother and father's shadow? How was she ever going to make a name? And it's not even making a name for herself. It's how is she going to express herself as an artist in a way that was unique and different from her mother and her father? I find that story fascinating. I find it fascinating because, first of all, how many children of superstars, and Judy Garland was a superstar and certainly for many years the superstar, plus her father, you know, obviously Vincent Minnelli, you know, is a genius. The MGM look that we know of, the MGM musical look, is so reliant on his vision. And to think of those two and Liza having to overcome all of the expectations. We went back and watched a lot of footage of interviews with her, with journalists from the 70s. And every question was, will you ever be as good a singer as your mother? Will you ever be as good a dancer as your mother? Do you really have movie star looks? Would your father have ever hired you? I mean, it's just incredible. And, you know, we have a scene in the film where, you know, a French male, I may add, journalist asked her, you know, what do you say to people who say you're ugly? You know, which is like, you know, it's almost comedy. I mean, people in the theater when they watch it are like aghast. I laugh out loud because to me, you're looking at Liza, she's like 25, 24. She's gorgeous. And her eyes are like, you know, glittering with just excitement and this kind of fizzy, bubbly energy. And this guy's asking, you know, how does it feel like to be ugly? It's just unbelievable. These expectations on Liza Minnelli from such an early age made the fact that she was privileged, which she was born on third base. She had absolutely, you know, Hollywood royalty as her family, parents. And yet she was able to get from home to, from third base to home in a way that in some ways was harder than for many other people rounding all the bases, because they don't have those expectations, terrible expectations, the black cloud following her. And I think, you know, I just say, how many children of mega celebrities, stars, talented stars like Judy and Vincent, how many of their children in Hollywood have a, you know, halfway amazing career as Liza? How many have attained the status of their parents, let alone in some eyes exceeded it in some ways? How many can you count? Not many. And I think that's that kind of conflict of great personality, Liza, great story, how Liza became Liza. And obviously it helps that, you know, she's a damn good singer. So, you know, worst case scenario, you get into, you know, a corner, you just let her sing and, you know, brings down the house every time.
In researching her life, especially with the 25 hours of newly found footage that you had access to, did you come across anything that even surprised you when you were researching Liza Minnelli?
Well, the two things that surprised me about Liza as we made this film was, A, this idea of privilege for her being a double-edged sword. And because of the expectations, how hard it was for her to kind of make a name for herself. That was a kind of eye-opener as we delved into it. And the other thing that was very kind of inspirational in a way was the lesson that you could almost take out of Liza's life about the power of mentors to kind of transform us. And I think a lot of us keep people who can help us, mentors, you know, at kind of an arm's length, and they don't let them in. And as a result, you know, they may not go as far or may not develop their talent as much as it could be if they kind of let these, you know, mentors into their life. So I think one of the surprising things is seeing how important mentors, her mentors were to her, how much they helped transform her and focus her enormous talent. And also kind of a lesson to all of us that, you know, open yourself up to mentors and you're probably going to be a better, more talented, more successful person.
I just have a handful of minutes left with you. Here's my last question for you. You make an incredibly entertaining and insightful documentary telling Liza Minnelli's story. Star-studded. You've got George Hamilton. You've got Mia Farrow. Ben Vereen. The late, great Chita Rivera, just to name four legends. My last question for you, what do you hope audiences come away with after they've experienced Liza?
That's a good question. I think that for me, I'm always looking at pleasing two audiences and having them both take away something. I think for core Judy and Liza fans, I want them to take away a profound understanding of how Liza became Liza, how important her mother was to that equation, but how important it was for Liza to spread her wings and kind of go forth. And quite frankly, the other side of the equation, people who may not know that much about Liza, I want them to take away, my God, I thought she was a sitcom star, and she is one fucking mega talented woman. And it sounds crazy, but I mean, as we produced the film, we would often talk to people of different ages, and we'd say like, do you know who Liza's mother is? And we were shocked. I'm saying 50, maybe 40% of the people who are, let's say, under 35 did not know Judy Garland was Liza's mother. So I think that being able to explain who Liza was and show how remarkable she was and tell this story of mentorship and the importance of it, I think if people get half of that when they watch the film, I will be very, very happy. And hopefully, as a lot of the reviewers have said, which is maybe the highest compliment, is as soon as I finish the movie, I watch Cabaret. You know, that in some way is one of the great, you know, greatest reviews you can get.
You know, just on an aside, from the UK, there was in 2023, there was a 5-CD box set of like 80s gay dance floor hits that was released. One of those tracks was Don't Drop Bombs, Liza Minnelli and Pet Shop Boys.
I thought you were going to do Losing My Mind, Pet Shop Boys.
No, they chose that particular song.
Interesting.
Yes. Funny. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, I'm going to have to, defend the film against people who are saying, why didn't you put in the Pet Shop Boys and Liza? But unfortunately, that, as well as many other storylines, just couldn't fit in once we kind of honed this film.
Absolutely.
To tell the story of her mentors.
Absolutely. I have to say, Bruce David Klein, well said, well done, well made. An absolutely excellent, excellent film. Well done. Thanks for being
on
the show.
Go see the movie. We want fannies and seats to experience Liza. And nothing like it seeing her on the big screen. She's just incredible.
Gather around, I got a story to tell.
A Grammy, an Emmy, even an Oscar. She has done it all.
She has achieved that rare status where only a first name is necessary.
The one and only Liza.
You thought I didn't see you now, didn't you?
Born to Hollywood royalty.
Vincente Minnelli.
Superstar Judy Garland.
I thought, Mama, she's never going to pass.
Her fight was to find who she was. She didn't want to be a mother.
Her mother's passing was a catalyst.
A period of incubation.
She found friends and mentors who helped her.
He gave her an entire sense of self.
There was so much expected of her.
She had the thing that you can't teach.
She blossomed.
Everybody wanted to be with Liza. Everybody wanted her at their parties.
She's hot, she's sexy, she's weird, and she had that fierceness and so much vulnerability.
How are you doing?
Terrific. Fine. I feel wonderful about love.
Excuse me.
Because I wanted it to be like it was in the songs.
That last husband of hers, I was at the wedding. Oh, my God.
Legendary actress and singer Liza Minnelli has checked into rehab.
I was very worried.
How lucky I was to have gone through all of the bad stuff that I've gone through, because it prepared me for the rest of my life.
If the public sees Liza as a barrel of sequins and glamour, they've got her wrong.
She wanted to consume the fullness of life. I don't think she has any regrets.
Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story, opens in Canada in select cities, Toronto, Ottawa, and Vancouver. starting January 31st. For more information, simply visit zeitgeistfilms.com.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex desire was, what it meant, and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way and who deserve legal protections just as racial minorities do, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book, about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 67 in 1935, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators' backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm Keegan Hurst, former professional rugby player, coach, raving homosexual, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tarrant.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, from the 2023 5-CD box set compilation, Box of Sin, Don't Drop Bombs, Liza Minnelli.
Don't drop bombs. Bombs. Bombs.
Bones. Baby. Students, have you stumbled in your course and want a fresh start? Well, At the Best University has your back. AU offers more than 850 courses that align to your program, so you can retake your course online, turn that grade around, improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit atthebascu.ca to browse our online courses and transform your education today.
Danger, danger. The following contains explicit content. Please use caution while you are tuned in.
Hi, I'm Joey Lamar, best-selling author of Mambo Lips,